That's Matthew Tembo, born in, well, at least lived primarily in Lusaka for much of his life, is currently based in the United States. In 2013, he was based in Illinois. I don't know if he's still there now. Maybe, maybe not. In any event, we're going to hear two of his tracks to end off tonight's show, Nela and Kumalia Ndimu. Let's hear them now.
Smiles on your face, even years away. Wrinkles on my face, even when face away. Your love I could feel so strongly, no matter how far away. Deep down my heart, I knew that I loved you. I took all that for granted, yes, for what? I don't know. Forget the worst, let's try the best. Yeah. I cannot stand this pain I feel inside. Ela, Ela, Ela.
Haya bone na nena pa umpawi wako. Ukachita chiba palie oluwa ukachita chapino palie okumbuka bebe anojitira chapino akongo kumumbusha ai bala zebe kumbuta ai babose kakuchita akune kuluwa amama pende kufa heni ushilaru mwangu ambo bacha lopa sala kumbala ni batu awasala nao nilipondo aso ana mikombo Sola lomba osa yeso kocha jiwa Akoneshe kulika ningo kutu yewe Asasa lemo lebela na tuha wikwako Utakufa ezo ukasikoda wa tutu Osa wondo seka seka mutima muli winu Na mulungu lomba bantu amulu wila tuwene mutu muyago Alie na yechito Koma babuji neze mana neze meso kyoko Osa ziba kuta mama okambaji Nilo pana kula ala ziwonela Kumbaya nimu Kuliko Kumbaya nimu Kundarani Kumbaya
Those were two tracks by Matthew Tembo, and on that note, are going to conclude this Night Wounds time for tonight. Join me next week, where the letters J, K, and L, we'll be covering the 12th largest world metropolitan areas in the world, which will be Joinville, I might be mispronouncing that one, in Brazil. I might be mispronouncing it because I'm not sure if it's meant to be pronounced in a French or Portuguese style. In any event, also we'll be featuring on Kaohsiung in Taiwan, Republic of China, and also we'll be focusing on La Paz, Bolivia. That should be fun. Stay tuned for that next week. For now, we take you to the BBC overnight.
Just yet, it's thought to be too early for that, but basically there's going to be a ceremony to mark what happened, to allow pupils and staff to come together and grieve. For one of the teachers, Andalib Aftab, it's going to be a particularly difficult day. Her son was killed in the attack that she survived. She's been speaking to Shana Khalil, the BBC's Pakistan correspondent, about that awful day and about how she feels about going back to work.
I saw many boys rushing out of the auditorium from the window inside the staff room. So there was a little wish inside my heart that along with the many other boys, he might have rushed out of the auditorium.
How did you know what happened to your son?
I was injured. The army, they took me to the hospital. They told me to call your brother or your husband. So when I called my brother, he told me that your boy is no more now. And I was expecting my boy in 3 or 4 pieces. But alhamdulillah, he was just smiling. He was, as you can see the picture, he's a little chubby. So he was having the sweet laughter on his face at that time.
Andalib Aftab speaking there, one of the teachers and obviously a mother too, as she talks about her little boy. Well, we can speak to our correspondent Shajib Jilani is outside the school in Peshawar as they begin returning. Welcome back to the programme, Shajib. The time there just coming up to about 14 minutes past 11 in the morning. Can you tell me what has happened so far today?
Well, this morning, first time the school opened its gates to students, teachers and parents at about 8 a.m. local time. They held a ceremony which lasted about 2 hours, remembering their classmates and friends and relatives who died in the massacre. And they were received by Pakistan's powerful army chief, Raheel Sharif, who offered reassurances that government will do everything to protect school children. And he said the only way to fight terrorism is through education. So we've been talking to parents and teachers, and many of them have mixed feelings about returning to this place. And yet many of them are determined to carry on with their education.
Because that was one thing at the time, Shajib, whether people might return or not. Do you think that most people have?
Most people have. Now, schools across Pakistan have reopened today after an extended winter holiday. And there are, you know, in for example, Karachi and Punjab, many parents are still apprehensive. Some schools have not opened because they haven't installed new security measures required by the government. But by and large, people are returning and they are looking forward to it.
Can you see a difference in the security presence at the school today?
At the Army Public School, which was attacked,
yeah.
Yes, we can see the boundary walls have been raised. There are barbed wires. There is troops security presence. But that's not the case with every school across the country. And many of the private schools are now negotiating with the government in terms of who will bear the extra cost of security measures. And some of the schools have not opened, frankly, because they did not do anything over the last few weeks to strengthen security. But that remains the major concern.
And just in our last 30 seconds, has the government done anything differently with its policy towards the Taliban following this attack?
Well, in the last 3 weeks, we've seen the Pakistani parliament pass an amendment to the constitution setting up military courts where they will try these terror suspects. The government has also lifted moratorium on death penalty, and they've hanged quite a few terror suspects in the last few weeks. That's the government response, but many people believe that it's the government policy which needs to change towards good Taliban and bad Taliban. They need to go across the board and root out this menace of militancy in Pakistan.
Thanks very much, Shajib Jalani, outside that school in Peshawar, the army school that was attacked last month, and the time there, 11:17 in the morning.
You're listening to Newsday with Lawrence and Nuala. Sport and business on the way. Also the latest from the Golden Globes. The headlines, though, French ministers are holding a crisis security meeting a day after more than 3 million people took part in marches across France. And Indonesian divers, as we'll be hearing in a few moments, have recovered the flight data recorder from the Air Asia plane.
Well, let's get our sports headlines now. Viv Nunes is here.
Good morning, Nuala and Lawrence. Well, crisis, what crisis? That's what they're saying at Barcelona this morning after an emphatic 3-1 win over La Liga champions Atletico Madrid. There had been talk of a growing rift between star forward Lionel Messi and coach Luis Enrique. There was even rumours Messi might be looking to leave the new camp and join the Premier League, can you imagine? Well, the Argentinian has put all that to bed. He scored one and set up 2 goals during the win on Sunday. He then made a rare appearance on Barcelona's in-house TV channel, saying he had no intentions of leaving and he didn't ask the club to fire anyone. You can't get much clearer than that. One person who does look set to move clubs, though, is Wilfried Bony. Manchester City have agreed a fee of $42 million for the Swansea City striker. I'll have more on that and the story dominating the British sports pages this morning. Southampton's 1-0 win over Manchester United that sees them leapfrog the Reds into third place on the table.
Thanks very much, Vivian. And we have some business news as well. And Tony Bonsignore is here.
Yeah, OK. First story. Not very pleasant, this, while you're having your breakfast. So forgive me in advance.
OK.
Another food scandal in China, food safety scandal in China. This one particularly gruesome. The Ministry of Public Security in China has arrested 110 people suspected of selling pork from pigs that died from disease. They've also confiscated 1,000 tonnes of contaminated pork. We've had a run of these stories, haven't we? We've had tainted milk powder, we've had donkey meat. It's really gruesome stories. The authorities in China saying 11 groups involved in this. It goes back to 2008. Essentially, they buy these pigs very cheaply that have died from disease. They bribe the food supervisory authorities to get the certificates they need, and then they sell it in markets or even goes into making processed bacon or cooking oil. Another blow, as I say, for Chinese food manufacturers. Already series of similar scandals we've already heard, as I said. The likes of McDonald's, Walmart, they've all become embroiled in these sort of scandals. They have pledged stronger oversight. They said they've prosecuted 75 people, but increasing confidence, it's going to be difficult when you keep getting stories like this.
And a change of tack. Detroit, you've been taking a look at cars.
Yeah. Yeah, petrol heads will know all about this, I think. The North American International Auto Show kicks off today. The Detroit Motor Show is what most people will know it as. Notable for a few reasons this year. It's going to be busier than it has been in recent years. The US car industry really on the up at the moment. Motoring ahead, if you like, after a few difficult years after the financial crisis. Secondly, there's a big change in the sort of cars that people are buying as well. A couple of years ago, it was all about electric cars, smaller cars. If you've been to the States, I know you have over a number of years, you've noticed the cars getting smaller and smaller each time you get, not anymore, they're getting bigger and bigger and bigger again. And that's
why
to do
is
with
that, I wonder,
price of gasoline and the fact that the economy is on the way back up. The big trend this year, big SUVs, big trucks, that sort of thing again. And also Detroit as well. Detroit is a city also slightly on the way up, people feel. So this is a big opportunity. The world's eyes on Detroit, a chance for them to sell themselves.
Such an interesting city, Detroit. Maybe you're listening on WDET. You're very welcome to the programme to Newsday. Thanks very much, Tony. Lawrence Pollard and Nuala McGovern with you this morning. The time in London, 6:21. And we can move on now to AirAsia. A couple of headlines coming in with that particular story. Lawrence was mentioning there that the flight data recorder had been recovered. Well, also divers are saying that they found the cockpit voice recorder also from the downed AirAsia plane. Now, they haven't retrieved that yet, is my understanding. We can speak with our correspondent, Karishma Vaswani, who is in Jakarta. Karishma, just hearing that news also that the voice recorder has been found, what do they hope, the authorities hope to find with those two items, the black box, so to speak, right, and the voice recorder?
Well, the black box contains these two items, the flight data recorder and the cockpit voice recorder. Earlier today, Navy divers were able to retrieve the flight data recorder. On that, remember, is contained a sort of forensic physical timeline of what happened to the plane in the last moments before it crashed. So you'd get the altitude of the plane, whether or not it stalled before it crashed, everything that has to do with the technical aspects of the aircraft. So that's actually really critical for investigators to piece together why this plane plunged into the Java Sea. Now, these reports coming in about the fact that the cockpit voice recorder has been located, we understood from officials earlier today that a series of pings had been sent out, and they were looking in the area of the Java Sea, quite close to where the flight data recorder was found. They were looking for the location of the cockpit voice recorder. It appears now that they've confirmed, they've found the location, but have as yet to bring the item up to the surface of the water. Now, this is really important, I should say, because on the cockpit voice recorder are the last few moments of the conversation between the captain and the co-pilots. Everything that happened on the plane would be recorded in voice format, if you will, on this piece of machinery. And that will be really important for relatives to understand what happened in the last few moments before the plane crashed.
So these two items will give the information, as you mentioned. Do you know when the public may get to hear exactly what's been found?
Well, typically in these sorts of investigations, a preliminary report is usually released within 3 weeks to a month of teams going through the data and analysing all of the evidence or the material that they find on these recorders. Remember, there's tons of data on this equipment. Indonesia has already said at the very beginning of the entire process that Indonesia will run the handling and the analysis of these flight data recorders and the cockpit voice recorder. But we do understand that it's likely international teams will also be involved. Remember, the aircraft was a French plane, so it's likely that French investigators will be involved. And the black box itself is an American product, so it's possible that the American teams will be involved as well. But certainly Indonesia does have experience, if you will, in these sorts of investigations. The unfortunate silver lining, I suppose, of having had so many air disasters over the last decade is that teams here are very well equipped with this sort of technology and the ability to analyse what's on these recorders.
Thanks very much, Karishma Vaswani in Jakarta speaking to us. And I suppose I should also let you know that that search international also for the fuselage and the remaining missing passengers and crew does continue in the Java Sea. But no doubt the divers are happy that they'd have at least have these two pieces of information that they'll begin working with to try and understand exactly what happened.
It's that time when beautiful people spend time looking at one another. That's all I've seen on the screens here. It's like gorgeous people applauding one another, saying, oh, you're looking gorgeous. The Hollywood Awards season has begun, and it's the Golden Globes. Interesting, slightly more radical sort of curtain raiser, I suppose, often seen as an indicator towards the Oscars. Rebecca Sun is a senior reporter at The Hollywood Reporter and has been following it. I gather it's just ended. So what's the top line for you? Who was the big winner?
The big winner tonight was definitely Boyhood. It won Best Motion Picture in the Drama category, which is generally a good forecast for what will happen during the Oscars. It's been a favorite for a while now, but it also won Best Director for Richard Linklater and Patricia Arquette for Supporting Actress. So that kind of confirmed what we knew about Boyhood going into the Oscars.
Now, that's interesting. What do you think it's being praised for? I mean, it's an unusual film in that it follows its character growing up in real time. So the little boy is a little boy when it begins, and then he grows up. He's filmed across a series of years. It's an incredibly original, clever thing. Do you think that's why it's being singled out?
That's definitely a lot of it. I think people are very enamored of that premise, the idea that you could do a project over the course of 12 years, that a studio, in this case IFC, would have the faith, you know, in an artist, in a filmmaker, in order to, you know, accomplish this sort of thing. And I think it's the kind of idea that maybe other filmmakers would have considered doing but not actually executed. And so there's a lot of admiration for them being able to pull it off. But the other thing is, the movie really is resonating with a lot of people. It's so simple. You know, the plot is not, there's no fireworks, you know, in the story. And it's literally just a story of, you know, a boy becoming a man and in the suburbs of the United States. And I think it really just hits home for a lot of people watching it, at least here in America.
You're just watching life, aren't you, basically evolve, and I suppose all those experiences. I have to say, I was gripped. When I was watching it, I absolutely loved it. And you just kind of, and apparently the young boy in it, he did not see himself growing up until the final film was made 12 years later and was like, whoa, that was my life. That's what just happened. What else struck you during it? I quite enjoyed watching a little bit of Tina Fey and Amy Poehler, who were hosting it, poking fun at quite a few of the celebrities that were there. But what about some of the winners?
Right. Well, over in the comedy category for motion pictures, you saw, you know, Michael Keaton, who a lot of people, another actor that a lot of people have been looking at in the Best Actor race. He indeed took home the Golden Globe for the comedy category. Now, it's in, again, remember that the Oscars will combine the comedy and drama genres. So, you know, but he's still a front runner for that. And it was great to see. I mean, Michael Keaton's an actor who's been, you know, well respected in Hollywood for decades, but, you know, kind of by his own volition stayed off the radar. And to so see him get all this, you know, well-deserved attention now has been great for a lot of people. That was really fun. It was a surprise, though, that his movie Birdman didn't win Best Motion Picture. Instead, that went to Grand Budapest Hotel, you know, the Wes Anderson ensemble comedy.
Yeah,
it's very quirky. It's super Wes Anderson, you know, and it came out kind of very early in Oscar season. It came out last year. And so that was definitely a surprise.
Right. Many, many thanks indeed. Rebecca Sun, senior reporter at The Hollywood Reporter, looking at the Golden Globes. Also, one other film thing just to mention. If you ever think of a Swedish stunner in a long black dress, blonde, dancing in a fountain, it's got to be Anita Ekberg. She's died, aged 83, made famous by Federico Fellini's 1960 film La Dolce Vita, when she wades through Rome's Trevi Fountain. Unforgettable.
With bbc.com/news, you get the latest news stories anytime you like. bbc.com/news offers you the most comprehensive news coverage in the world, and its stories are easy to search and navigate. Whether you're interested in science, health, technology, or business, the bbc.com/news website can offer it all. It also gives you the opportunity to listen live to our news output or check the latest breaking news with our minute-by-minute news feed. If you want to take the news with you, we offer you downloadable podcasts to listen at your convenience, or archive programming so you can catch up on the programs you've missed. Or you can access bbc.com/news on your mobile phone. bbc.com/news also lets you give feedback direct to our program teams. All this content, coverage and opportunity makes the BBC the world leader in news coverage online. bbc.com/news.
Hello, welcome to Newsday from the BBC World Service with Lawrence Pollard and Nuala McGovern. The day after France's biggest demonstration in living memory, what next? Solidarity expressed, one plotter on the run, but politicians calling for more security around Europe.
Also, we'll be hearing from the Catholic Archbishop of Jos in central Nigeria after some appalling atrocities carried out by Boko Haram, and a bit of good news from Sierra Leone.
BBC News with Stuart McIntosh. The French government is holding a crisis meeting to discuss security a day after millions of people took to the streets to denounce last week's attacks in Paris by Islamist gunmen. President François Hollande will chair talks with cabinet ministers at the Elysee Palace. Police are still searching for any further accomplices of the three men who killed 17 people. Pupils and teachers have returned for the first time to the school in the Pakistani city of Peshawar, where more than 140 people were killed in a Taliban attack last month. Heightened security is in place with soldiers and police deployed at the premises. Divers in Indonesia have recovered the black box flight data recorder from the Air Asia plane that crashed into the Java Sea 2 weeks ago. Officials say the cockpit voice recorder has also been located, but it's yet to be retrieved. A Catholic archbishop in central Nigeria has called for the same united resolve against Boko Haram as has been seen against militant Islamists in France. The Archbishop of Jos, Ignatius Kagama, said international resources should be mobilised to halt the group's advance in Nigeria. He said the Nigerian military was unable to tackle the group. The South Korean president, Park Geun-hye, says she's open to the idea of talks with the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un. In a televised news conference to mark the new year, she said ending North Korea's nuclear program should be an important part of the discussions, but it wasn't a precondition. In his New Year message at the beginning of the month, Kim Jong-un offered to hold talks at the highest level. The film Boyhood has emerged as the big winner at the Golden Globe Awards in Los Angeles. The movie, which took 12 years to make, was named Best Film Drama. It also picked up Best Director for Richard Linklater, and Patricia Arquette was named Best Supporting Actress.
Many thanks indeed for the latest, Stuart. This is Newsday with Nuala and Lawrence. Coming up, voices from that march, the extraordinary march, the largest demonstration, people are saying, living memory in France. Also, we shouldn't forget the horrific toll in northern Nigeria. We'll be hearing from the Archbishop of Jos. And also, Umaru Fofana joins us once again from Sierra Leone on the significance of one district in the country being declared Ebola-free. All that and Nuala speaks like a monkey. Stay tuned. It's Newsday from the BBC.
You know, actually, Lawrence, you just reminded me that there was a headline in The Atlantic that I saw before we came on air that was talking about Nigeria and just so many people that were killed in the town of Baga and how it was in Paris's shadow that they were basically saying it should be making front page news as well. We're going to get into that story this half hour here on Newsday. But first, we will speak a little bit about France, being called the Republican March. It was in response to the killings of 17 people by Islamist extremists. 3.7 million was one of the figures that I saw quoted that were walking side by side in Paris and cities across the country, and the message was unity and solidarity.
Well, the pictures are incredible. Let's hear the sounds of the day now. Our correspondent Chris Morris was amongst the crowd in Paris.
It's 3 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. A low winter sun is casting long shadows across a vast sea of people spilling out of the Place de la République. And this march of national solidarity, France's response to a terrifying few days, has just begun. And it was genuinely huge. Close to 2 million people in Paris, more than 3.5 million countrywide. Quite an answer to the gunmen who sought to scare this country. There were banners and flags and slogans, the largest draped across the statue of Marianne, said simply in French, Charlie, I think, therefore I am.
I hope it may help people to think they're fighting for political reasons and they can find some ways also to work more together.
We come here for peace between Muslim between Jewish, Catholic, Christian, whatever, Catholic, Buddhist. Catholic. We are tired of this. We don't want this in France.
These people must not be dead for nothing. Now the government has to take the decisions to organize something with Europe and with all the world that this never happens again.
I've now come up to a balcony above the march, and the crowd really does stretch back as far as the eye can see. Just below me, there's a man with a huge yellow pencil, which has become one of the symbols of press freedom. And a little earlier we saw a man standing on a bus stop with a homemade banner on a white sheet. "I'm a Muslim, not a terrorist," it said. Back at ground level, a Muslim family has turned up with buckets and buckets of white roses, giving them to passers-by. Why are you handing out flowers?
Because we are Muslim and we are French. We are for the liberty. We are together when things happen.
Are you still confident about the future of being a Muslim in France?
Yeah. I hope everyone will be intelligent and not thinking about bad things about us.
Across the square, a Jewish man with one of the flowers in his hand.
He say, "I give you this just for the peace," and I tell him that we are with you and we are very happy you are here. And we take a photo with him to show all over the world that the Muslim and the Jewish can live together.
But his daughter, representing a younger generation, isn't quite so sure.
Given these violent events, the country is changing, so I don't know if I'll stay in France in the future.
And there's no disguising the fact that this extraordinary day of unity won't paper over all the cracks. For all the Muslims in this crowd, there are plenty of others who do feel disenfranchised, alienated. But only three gunmen, more than 3 million people marching against everything they represent. For France, those feel like pretty good odds.
Chris Morris and reporting on the voices from the crowd in Paris yesterday. Of course, it's not about the numbers. Well, it is, isn't it? 17 dead, 3.5 million come out to demonstrate, an unknown number who've been killed in northern Nigeria. And where are the demonstrations and the whole world converging? It's a question that a couple of our listeners are asking. Ibarakumo B. Wilson compares the situation in Nigeria to that in France, saying double standards in international politics. The whole world converged in France to mourn victims of a terror attack. No one cares about Nigeria's situation. That's his take. Somebody who has been talking about it is the Catholic Archbishop of Jos in central Nigeria. So often we see, we used to see Jos as a sort of a flashpoint between the Muslim and Christian sectors in Nigerian society. Well, the Archbishop is calling for the whole world to support Nigeria in its fight against Boko Haram, just as the world rallied around France and Charlie Hebdo. Ignatius Kaigama is also president of the Nigerian Bishops' Conference. And he's been speaking after two explosions ripped through Yobe State and the recent slaughter of hundreds of people, still literally countless because no one's actually got there for an accurate count, in the town of Bara, right up on the border in the far northeast. This programme's Sunita Nahar caught up with the Archbishop and began by asking him for his reaction to what's been happening in Bara.
It's a monumental tragedy. It has saddened all of Nigeria, but seemingly we seem to be helpless, because if we could stop Boko Haram, we would have done it right away. But they continue to attack and kill and capture territories and do it with such impunity means they seem to have the upper hand.
What exactly do you know has happened in the town of Baga?
I know that many have been killed, children and old people. That's the story we hear. Nobody can give you an accurate description of what has happened there, because I believe even the soldiers had to run for their life. And whatever we are told is just what we hear. That is all. So I don't want to disbelieve anybody who says that many people have been killed. I believe certainly there have been so much casualties.
But what about the authorities in Nigeria itself? Are they doing enough?
They say they are doing enough, but from the reports we get of daily attacks and terrible massacres, it means that what they are doing is not good enough. Their best is not good enough. And always saying that something can be done better.
Archbishop, you seem to be implying that you need international help. Is that the case?
Yes, we certainly need help to overcome this terrorist group because they seem to be expanding and growing more sophisticated in their approach, and they are claiming lives and displacing so many Nigerians.
But I understand that the U.S. is providing some sort of help.
The question is, if the U.S. has been providing the intelligence and assisting in one way or the other, why the growing destruction? Why the, activities of Boko Haram becoming so sophisticated? And so I wonder the quality of help. That is where I question the kind of help being offered. But how effective is that help? How can it bring this situation to a halt?
So what is your message, really, to the rest of the world?
Let us act together. I think it is important to feel concerned when one part of the world is in trouble, whether it is in the Middle East, whether it is in sub-Saharan Africa, whether it is in Europe or America. I think we should be genuinely concerned for one another and do what we can. Like, I see the very positive response of the French government in tackling the issue of religious violence after the killing of their citizens. They are doing something very, very positive and putting in all they can in order to ensure that this does not happen again. So we need that spirit to be spread around, not just when it happens in Europe, but when it happens in Nigeria, in Niger, in Cameroon, in any poor country, that we mobilize our international resources and face or confront the people who bring such sadness to many families.
Well, that's the Catholic Archbishop of Jos in central Nigeria, Ignatius Kaigama, speaking to this programme, Sunita Nahar.
And just reading some more of your comments that are coming in on our Facebook page, Suleiman Jafar Kabir, he feels that no world leader has condemned those terror attacks in Nigeria, let alone staging a unity rally, except during the abduction of the Chibok schoolgirls. He says are the victims of terrorism in Nigeria, not human beings. So you can have a little read of that conversation taking place, facebook.com/BBC Africa.
And speaking of the international demonstration, there is a double-page picture, it has to be a double-page picture, in one of the British newspapers to take in all the leaders. From the left, Spain's PM Mariano Rajoy, all the way to the right. Who's on the right? It's the Swiss president, Simonetta Sommaruga. There are 46 or so world leaders who turned up to march in support of Charlie Hebdo in Paris yesterday. The organisation Reporters Without Borders, however, has been a little bit cheeky. Well, not cheeky, they was perfectly entitled to do so. They pointed out that among the leaders expressing their solidarity for freedom of speech were leaders from Algeria, Egypt, Turkey, Russia, UAE, who quite happily imprison journalists. So they're calling the bona fides of some of those leaders who were there saying, "Je suis Charlie," wondering whether indeed they would extend to their own journalists the same care that they're supporting and saying should be extended to French journalists.
Interesting to see them all linking arms. It's kind of a picture that we haven't seen before with world leaders when they do stand with one another. Well, some good news now on the Ebola front, and it is that news from Sierra Leone reveals that one district called Pujehun in the southeast of the country has been declared Ebola-free. It passed the benchmark set by the World Health Organization of 6 weeks without any new infection. Let's speak to Amaro Fofano in the capital, Freetown. Nice to have you on, Amaro, for some good news. Tell us a little bit more of the details of this town.
Well, good news indeed. Good morning. Pujahon is in the south of Sierra Leone, and it hasn't really officially been declared Ebola-free because it is something which the UN World Health Organization is shying away from doing, saying that it declares countries and not districts as Ebola-free. But okay, the district has gone for like 48 days without a confirmed Ebola case, which the authorities there are celebrating, not least its district chairman, who says that this has worked because of their measures, and one of those measures...
Maro Fafana, I think you've gone. We'll try and reconnect with you. So we're just about to find out what the measures were, because very interesting, because there was a spike, as we were hearing, around Freetown in